Hasan Sagar was a person who I admired and enjoyed enormously, and whenever I had any questions, he would take the time to explain them to me very carefully and so forth. But this, the one thing that I really remember has more to do with his attitude toward chemistry than it does with any specific influence that he worked on me. I had never encountered a person whose knowledge of all of chemistry could compare with that of Ansager. He was profoundly interested in inorganic chemistry, and he knew the structures, and he followed the new ones that came out by X-ray, and he had all of that in his head. When I arrived, Harold Zeiss was an assistant professor working, as I say, on following up on work by Hein, H-E-I-N, a German chemist who had examined the reaction of chromium trichloride, might it have been, with Grignard reagents, phenyl, magnesium, bromide, things like that, and got out all these weird compounds and so forth, the structures which weren't known. And somehow Ansager got interested in these 42 papers that Hein had written, to a point where he knew every melting point, every property that was recorded on these unknown substances, and he would come in the morning to ask Harold, well, now, what's, you know, new on this and that? And it was Ansager who finally realized that these were chromium zero compounds. And what had made it very difficult was that in the reaction of phenyl magnesium bromide with chromium, I think it's trichloride. You can tell what kind of an inorganic chemist I am. And the product looked as if it was chromium and three benzene rings, and it was Ansager who finally realized that if one unit was benzene and the other was diphenyl, and that it was just some radical reaction that had also intervened to link two of the benzene rings together to give diphenyl, and then these two things had reacted with chromium zero. So the prominent compound wasn't a simple one in that sense, but it really was Ansager's doing. And that's, you see, that's the first pi complex with a metal in a zero valence state, dibenzene chromium. Then it all got cleared up pretty nicely. But to see that guy's interest, intense interest, and then this wide knowledge, because after all, here is a person who is, trying to calculate how fast protons should diffuse in ice. And is worrying about the difference between helium-3 and helium-4. Oh, he is unbelievable. He really is the quintessential example of the guy who sleeps through the seminar and then appears at the end to ask a devastating question. It's as if he knew the whole story before it started.
It was during this time that, remember correctly, that you did, well, let's see, it's a little later than the point we're at. I was thinking of Leo Szilard, and that comes a little bit later. That was 62.
Well, my first connection with Leo, though, where I first met him in 1952 in New York, he had become interested in the world population problem and had the idea that the basic knowledge of the reproductive process might have advanced
further than applications that could have stemmed from the basic knowledge. First, on the ground that few scientists are concerned about practical applications of their basic work by nature. And second, that in the area of birth control, there were strong prejudices floating around. So he convinced the Conservation Foundation in New York, which was concerned with the conservation of animals, that one of them was the human, and he wasn't concerned about the survival of the other animals, because then he could have said, well, we've got to control the human race in order to spare the rest of the world. But he didn't have that notion yet. But then even so, his idea was to bring in biologists and medical people whose research had been in the area of human reproduction, and question them what they had done and were there any possible applications, just, you know, direct their thinking toward it. But it was clear to him that he needed an organic chemist to listen in. And one of the demographers, his name Kingsley Davis, who at Columbia, who later went to California, suggested, gave him my name, and so we did that, and together, and that was, you know, quite fascinating itself. Nothing much came out of it. Turned out, of course, that the pill was being developed in a Catholic institution by Rock. Where for some reason they didn't have a wit to put a stop to it. But he and I then never lost contact. We became very, very good friends. And so then some years later he wanted to see whether anything could be done politically to turn back the development of nuclear weapons and the prospect of their use. So
I understand that grew out of a series of lectures that he gave.
Yes.
And
Are We on the Road to War, or something
yes.
like that, and which I never heard, but I... But it was a nice idea, and it was a typically Szilardian idea that the American system had a Senate in which each state had two members regardless of its size. The House of Representatives was therefore no body that you could ever control, but the Senate looked at him and said, you can get control of it. Quite literally. And so he wanted an organization that would in effect do two things: raise money to help elect senators who were already in a general way opposed to the use of nuclear weapons, and who could see their long-term danger to the survival of a reasonable world, and then to have an educational activity going on in Washington once they arrived, bringing people in to give seminars. And that started in 62, so he called me up and asked me if I would, you know, come down and join the board, and I said yes. And well, as you know, what the missile crisis is in October 62.
Mm-hmm.
It's within months. And and Leo, who had kept alive during the Nazi period and so forth by having a suitcase packed all, and even at that time in Washington, he had a couple of suitcases packed so that if he felt things were getting too hot, he would leave. And he called me and said, look, Washington is, you can't make any progress here. There are, all the doors are closed. The place is just a calm before the storm, and you should leave. And he called several of his close friends and said, you should pack your bag and get out. And I said, well, no, I can't do that because my children are here. But I remember that really ominous weekend when it hadn't been decided, the kids were with me, and we just sort of drove around and figured, well, if it really goes, I'll drive to Maine. But he left and went to Geneva, saying that he thought he could be more effective there, but you can imagine what the reaction of a lot of people was to his just pulling out. And so he never really recovered his position in Washington as, you know, an authoritative, reliable figure. And so it was when he left, then it was a question of who would take over the operation. And so I said, well, I would begin to do the dirty work, the daily work, and so on. And I, for the next 16 years, really spent, on the average, one day a week in Washington, arranging seminars. I'm no lobbyist at all, but I got very good at helping with the elections. That was the, and I think that's just because I'm an organic chemist, and as you know, you pay attention to detail. And to get people elected, you have to pay attention to the smallest details in their campaigns and so forth. I mean, in retrospect, I don't think a single organization of that sort has very much impact. I finally simply ran out of steam. I couldn't write any more fundraising letters.
There was a controversy in the 70s, 72, I think, 73, about campaign funds and the way it was done, and some ruling from some government bureaucrat, because there's a flurry of interchange in Science magazine about that whole affair, and I know you're quoted because you were president at the time.
Yeah. Well, there was, that whole problem of controlling our elected officials through the use of money was a pretty nasty one. In the end, of course, what was done turned out to be counterproductive, and the political action committees, which were allowed, permitted, with the right to contribute up to $5,000, in the end was hopelessly counterproductive, because hundreds of these PACs were set up. And I guess we realized it at the time, and so we were in really, internally at least, in quite an ambivalent position, that we would, most of us realized we should be out of business. You shouldn't have a system that was corruptible in this way. We thought, of course, that our cause was a good one, and therefore we were on the right side. But nevertheless, in principle, it was a bad thing to do. And I think most of us knew that. But we also knew that this change was going to be devastatingly bad. And that has turned out to be true.
But the organization still exists.
The organization still exists. It raises a great deal of money, and then how effective it is, we have to ask. But around Well, by 74, it was pretty clear that there was a move to the what you call the right, and particularly in the small states where we'd had pretty good fortune. I mean, the very first person that we supported was George McGovern back in 62. And I forget, we raised $25,000 or something like that and gave it all to George McGovern. And he won by 500 and some odd votes. So there was a God smiling on the operation. He talked about that. It's also true that Wyoming was a small state and $25,000, just as Leo had expected, went a long way.
Were you surprised in those early days about the extent of support and financial support coming from people towards the candidates? As I understand it, they would contribute, they write the check in the candidate's name, but it would go through the...
Yeah, and they would mail a check to us, and we'd put a rubber band around it. That's right. So that as an organization, in that sense, we were never contributing. That we did occasionally give $1,000 here, $2,000 there, but... yes, I was, and I felt we had a tremendous responsibility to those persons. This seemed to me to be precious money that they were giving. It's not tax deductible. It was the hardest sort of money to for them to be giving, and I think that's one reason why I worked really quite hard at it, and particularly hard at in identifying good candidates and trying to assess realistically whether the money that you gave would make a difference. And so we considered it, or at least I considered it, and Steve Thomas, who was working with me, also considered it a failure if we won by more than 5%. I mean, it's just as bad as losing. I mean, you'd misspent their money if you won too easily. Do you want to? I need a break.
Sure. To the men's room. Would you like to? Many of the people on the board of the council. Washington has a funny attraction for people in the sense of making them feel important. And then it's you realize very quickly that the senators and congressmen that with whom one deals, for the most part, have as their number one priority in any event getting reelected. I mean, that's number one. Now everything else is secondary to that, but. On top of it, many of them I would just simply describe as egomaniacs. That is, that no issue was of much importance except insofar as it was going to increase their chances of getting elected. And I found a lot of them very unsavory types. For example, I was awfully pleased to see Cranston finally get it. He has seemed to me to be a really doubtful character from the very beginning, although he was, you know, he created his image as the great liberal and so on, but keep dealing with him and talking to him and so forth. Now, Fulbright was one of the noble people. And there were two or three senators who for whom accomplishing something useful, for helping to make a change, was important. But, and many of the people we elected, I guess, were better. But I mean, think of the weakness in a Frank Church. We played a big role in getting him in the first time. And then these weaknesses develop, and you've got no control over it at all.
Who were some of the other people who were active on your board? Charlie Price was involved?
Charlie, I got Charlie on the board because, as you know, he played a big role in the World Federalists. And he was really quite an effective lobbyist, which, I mean, going around to senators' offices and talking to them about a problem. But Matthew Meselson was on the board. He's a buyer, very well known because of the bee shit day, the bee dropping controversy in Vietnam. And were the was it poisonous gas or something like that, this yellow stuff? I mean he's explained it to me 5 times and I refuse to understand it. But he was he thought, for example, that his slender connection to Kissinger was the way to get things done, and so he actually would block the council, try to block the council from moving in certain directions, particularly during the Vietnam War, because it would offend Henry. Well, you can imagine how kindly I took to that kind of position. Roger Fisher, of Getting to Yes, the big international negotiator. Oh, we're still good friends, but Roger could only see things in the light of what they might do for Roger Fisher. He was tough to deal with. And who else was on the board?
Wasn't John Edsel involved early on?
He was involved early on, but he was never on the board.
Okay.
Yeah. Leo had some very complicated device for setting the thing up, and I could go back and dig it out, but the Council for a Livable World was supposed to be the action arm of the Scientists for a Livable World, and Edsel was one of the Scientists for a Livable World. We never heard from them again. Glory be. Funny time. But I don't think it was time misspent. I think an organization like that changes the atmosphere a little. But goodness, you can't look to one thing and say, well, if it hadn't been for the Council for the Livable World, the anti-ballistic missile fight would have gone the other way. It went the way it did because people didn't want those damn things in their backyard.
Were most of your contributors scientists, financial contributors?
A lot of them were. Yeah, it was very heavily from the scientific community. Yes.
How did you find that aspect of it, fundraising?
Well, as I say, I finally got worn down because, you know, you were forever writing letters that were going a little further than the reality that either as it existed or you could reasonably expect it to exist a year from now or 2 years from now. So it wasn't my cup of tea, but I tried to learn it as well as I could. And not say things that were just downright lies. But in the end, I thought we needed more effective lobbyists, and I thought George Kistiakowsky would be a great guy. So I worked very hard to get him on the board, and as soon as I did, as soon as that was accomplished, he really turned against me in a personally nasty way that made it very, very easy for me to resign, just sever all connections with it in 78. And that goes back, I guess I told you that a couple of weeks after I arrived at Harvard, he took me aside when we were walking back from the faculty club and said, Beale, I want you to know that I voted against your coming here.
And that was then just another example of the spillover from Woodward. I mean, I was in the Woodward camp, and Woodward and Kistiakowsky had been at odds the whole time that they were here. The Woodward, I think in part, they determined that the organic part of this department should excel. They should be better than the physical chemistry part, of which Kisti was the influential spokesman. Those must have been quite some days, but in any event, that was, as I told you, about the Yale business of Roger Adams. Saying if you want to ruin the department, take on Bill Nurey. That association with Woodward tells you a lot about Woodward. I mean, as a second order spillover,
that's amazing.